Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Renee's Heart to Heart. This is Renee. I'm glad you could join us this morning. Happy Monday. Well, today we are going to talk about real estate. I have invited a friend who is a local realtor who has been doing business in this area for about 5 years and has had over 200 transactions beneficial to potential buyers and to himself. Real estate is big business, and when I look through quick facts about owning your own home and stuff, 90% of people's their money, their assets are wrapped up in their home. And our homes, of course, and I use the word homes because for me, it's not just about a house. I have made a home out of a 10 by 50 trailer in my lifetime. I've made a home out of a cottage at a state park in upstate New York. I've made my home out of a beautiful home that had been vandalized and had, just was a big mess. So it's not just about the house. It's about what you make it into and the comfort it provides for you and your family. So I would say, and I'm a big believer in this, that the more organized your home is, your nest, your safe place, and I talk about this a lot, the better organized your outside life is. However, I do believe that real estate, such as it is, has become very confusing. Unless you've taken the time to really educate yourself about it, there's a lot of real estate jargon out there that I'll bet if we were to do a people on the street interview, people wouldn't be able to give you an answer. Unless maybe you were on Wall Street, and then I think probably then you could probably get some people who knew what you were talking about. But your regular run-of-the-mill, get-up-and-go-to-work-every-day person who probably already owns his own home still doesn't understand all of the real estate possibilities. And that's why I asked John to join us today, because I'm hoping through some of the questions that I'm going to ask him and some of his knowledge, we will be a little bit better prepared for anything that has to do with either purchasing a house, selling a house, looking into doing either one. And very sadly, a good percentage of our world today, working people that depend on to make the mortgage payment, pay the taxes, keep the insurance on their home, and just take care of their home, depend on their jobs. And as we know, jobs in the last 10 years have gotten increasingly more difficult to make enough money to be able to take care of that responsibility. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about our heavy hitters. In the world of the very wealthy, they're just getting more wealthy. I know that. And I know that to be true. All you have to do is pick up a magazine or read some of the stories that we see. Look at our sports people. My good God. Who'd have thought that if you taught your 10-year-old how to be a really good basketball player or football player or baseball player, that they'd be billionaires? Well, not me. So there's a lot of money out there, but some of us working stiffs who get up every day and work a 45 to 50-hour work week are just making ends meet, very sadly. So when we get confused about what the deal is with our homes, it gets to be very, very stressful. So we're going to talk about some of the information that's out there in the street, so to speak, and maybe get the straight facts on it. I'm going to bring Shelly in. John's not with us yet, but Shelly is here, so I'm going to bring her in so that we can talk about this a little bit before John joins us. Good morning, honey. How are you?
Oh, very good. Good morning, Rainey.
So I'm thinking, I talked to John a couple times this week, and again, we talked last night, and I said, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there who don't understand. Say they're looking for a house, and I mentioned to him a lot of people I know just drive around in neighborhoods that they like, and they'll see for sale signs, and they'll see phone numbers, and they call up, and they get the answer like, oh, that's a short sale, or, oh, that's, the bank owns that. Well, that doesn't mean anything to them. What does that mean? Does that mean I can't buy it? Does that mean I can buy it? Does that mean it's available to buy? There's a for sale sign. So it gets very, very convoluted and very confusing for most of us. Shelly is one of those kind of young women who goes out there and figures out what's going on if she doesn't understand it. And usually if something stumps her, she gets an answer by the end of the day. Not all of us are that organized or that analytical to be like Shelly. I suspect that some of the things we're going to talk about today, she's already very well aware of. But I do want everybody to understand that it's okay to not have all the answers in regard to stuff like this unless you've been immersed in this, you know, in this kind of atmosphere for a little while. It's understandable because some of these things change on a daily basis. So, I mean, I can remember when every morning when you got up on news, the borrowing rate was at the bottom of the screen. Do you all remember that? If you were looking for a mortgage, what the going rate was for your rate of return would be right there at the bottom. Now it's so iffy because there's so many different different ways you can do things. It gets very, very confusing. Do you have anything that you think you'd like to? I can add something.
1 minute, but I'm going to have to mute you just for a quick sec. I'll be right back. So I'm still on the show, though.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask Shel if there's a couple things that she'd like to make sure that we discuss with John. So just in case I haven't thought of everything, I want to ask John about foreclosure and repossession, short sales, bank-owned properties, reverse mortgages, balloon mortgages, fixed-rate mortgages, all of those kind of things so that we can maybe have a little bit better understanding. And if you are in a place, as we speak, where you're looking for a home or you're trying to sell your home or you're not sure what's going to serve you better, say you're in your late 50s or your early 60s and you're thinking about retiring and you're still making an enormous mortgage payment and you want to downsize, maybe we can talk about some of those kind of things as well. I'm going to bring John in. Shel, are you there yet? No, she must have something going on at home.
Oh, I'm here. I'm here. I saved a sticky frog this morning just before the show started. It ran in my house. I didn't want my cats getting it. So I caught it, and I set it outside, but I caught it in a plastic container, but it jumped against my hand because I used my hand as a cover. Evidently, I must have had sticky frog on my hand, and I just rubbed my eye while I was talking to you, and my whole eye just instantly started burning. I was like, oh, shit, I must have sticky frog goo on my fingers. So I'm in here.
Go ahead and wash up. I'm gonna bring John in because he's on now, and we're gonna start talking. You get some good soap and water and get washed up, Shel.
I just did. It's feeling
okay.
Better already.
Okay.
Concerns me.
John,
a
are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Beautiful Monday morning.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Good way to start the day, right? I see. I'm sitting in my office and I see the sun coming up, the sky's nice and blue. It's going to be hopefully a beautiful day here in South Florida, much better day than still some of our northern states are doing. They're still struggling with so much snow. Every morning on Facebook, I have so many friends up north. They send me all these snowy pictures, and I'm like, oh, gosh, you poor people.
Makes me feel a little guilty.
I remember what that's like. Yeah, I would never... I was there in December because my sister was so ill, and it was 16 degrees. There was not a lot of snow. There was snow, but not like they've had the rest of this winter. But, gosh, I said, I looked at all of them. I said, I don't know why you're all here. I don't know why the world isn't tipping towards the south because everybody's running there myself. So.
Well, I think they get their turn in the spring and the summer and the fall.
Yeah. You're right. It can be really, really beautiful there, although I'll tell you, in upstate New York in Ithaca, I was there a couple years ago in August, my husband and I, and I was too cold then. So, you know, that is what it is. But Shelley, this is John. John, this is Shelley. Shelley is my co-host, and we've been friends for a very, very long time, and I know she's going to have some questions to talk to you about as well. First, though, I'd like to ask you,
say
hello to each other.
Hi.
Can you tell us what is the true, from your point of view, the true statement of what where we are with real estate here in South Florida at this point in time? Is it a seller's market? Is it a buyer's market? I mean, you hear all this stuff in the street. It gets very, very confusing for us. What would you say is going on right now?
Yeah, sure. Well, standard disclaimer, all I can talk about is what I'm familiar with, which is the Palm Beach County area. But,
right.
As much as I have picked up, and I, between my own activities and talking to other people in the business, et cetera, and just putting it all together, we went through, you know, they always say that real estate is always local, and that's still true. And people in the media and the news shows, et cetera, they like to come up with some kind of sound bit and sounds good and gets attention. But the truth is every market still is local. For example, if we were talking about Miami, especially certain areas of Miami, I'd say things are very different. They have some pretty crazy things going on down there. It still seems to be a market frenzy. Our area, I would say, last year went through quite a correction. I remember talking to people last year, middle of last year, later half of last year, and telling them that I could show them a house that the sales price changed by $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in the last 12 months. And it was crazy. It was really crazy. I mean, the frenzy is a good word to describe it. And buyers were getting desperate and sellers were getting aggressive. And there are different factors affecting that. I always look to find the explanation behind what's happening, not just to see what's happening, but try to understand why it's happening. And that helps you understand where things are going. One of the big factors, I think, was interest rates. Interest rates generally are a big influence on real estate activity, and things were so low for so long, I think people got used to it, and when the writing got, you know, people started realizing, hey, you know what, good times are going to be over soon, Federal Reserve is finally getting serious about this tapering stuff that they're doing. If nobody understands what that's about, basically, Federal Reserve for quite a while has been essentially printing, I can't remember if it's $40 or $45 billion. I know they were doing $85 billion a month, and that was going to mortgages and the federal government debt, so about half of that. So $40 to $45 billion, they were printing and buying mortgages through the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, all that stuff. So essentially, they were pushing that money into the mortgage market, and that, I believe, is one of the primary reasons interest rates stayed so low. And they finally have gotten serious about scaling that back, and so interest rates have been inching up, and they've still got quite a ways to go, so interest rates should continue to go up if things continue to make sense. So everybody, once they realize interest rates are going up, it's like, okay, good times are over, we better hurry up and buy. At the same time, some very big players came into the market. We call them the hedge fund buyers, but they're these big groups out of Wall Street-type organizations, and they've been buying up thousands and thousands of homes, even in our area. I mean, literally, even, you know, just billions of dollars. They've been buying up single-family homes. They're buying all the best stuff, and especially the newer construction, gated communities, everything everybody else wants, and they are paying more than most anybody else could pay. And they drove the market up by all indications. And so I'm sure other things are going on, but it was quite a frenzy. And I'm hoping, you know, from what I can see, it was a correction. Because appreciation, long-term appreciation, only really happens, in my opinion, of course, but I think history proves it out, based on incomes going up overall. And I think we all know incomes really haven't gone up in a long time. If you go back over the 100-year period, real estate really only goes up pretty close to the inflation rate. So definitely we had a frenzy last year, driven by a few different factors, and all indications are that seems to have calmed down. And I think, you know, prices just went up to the point where buyers just couldn't pay and qualify for the mortgages. And so going into this year, at least the sense I get is things are calmer. I'm not certainly not going to say that prices are going to go down or anything negative is going to happen, but the frenzy seems to have calmed down. So that'd be my best assessment for our market today.
Well, and I agree. You said something very interesting to me that I thought about last night, and I thought we do need to talk about this a little bit, and that is, of course, salaries for your working people. I think that average today wages soon of about $10 an hour. Now, $10 an hour, I'm talking about from everybody from the dishwasher at your local Denny's to your housekeeper at Ramada Inn, those kind of folks that are putting in a good day, hard work, and their paycheck, a $400 paycheck, once taxes are taken out and everything, if they're really lucky, and if they're lucky enough to also have insurance, they're also paying some insurance out of that. So they might come home with, what, $320, maybe?
Sure.
You know, $320 times for the month is pitiful. So where can you get a mortgage that gives, in some cases, the only bread earner, if you will, in a household who's making $10 an hour, they cannot do this. They can't rent. They can't buy. They can't do anything because they're not making enough money. So, of course,
sure.
We still, nothing has been helped there. They want to make minimum wage $10 an hour, but they want to take 3 years to do it. How is that going to help these people?
Yeah, my personal opinion, I don't try to convince people to, you know, you get into the politics of everything, and I don't try to push it too far. I just try to sit back and observe. But basically, you know, I think that everything we've seen over the last 5, 6, 7 years, however long it's been since everything went into chaos, has been Band-Aids. Band-Aids, whatever is the political quick fix that gets people's attention, obviously, ultimately, all these people want to get elected. They want to look like they're doing something to help the situation. But the structural underpinnings of our system and our economy are very fragile and, in my opinion, illegitimate. In other words, all that growth through the boom and the craziness in 2005 and 2006 was fueled by debt. And since then, a lot of the debt has been liquidated But there's still so much debt out there, and everything's so shaky. And when individuals go to make purchasing decisions, it's all about the, you know, the short term. You know, a few dollars a month here, a few dollars a month there. Can I make this payment, make that payment? Very, very little in the way of stability. And stability is when people have minimal debt, and they have decent income, and they're putting extra, there's extra at the end of the month, and they're putting it away. So, unfortunately, our system here in the U.S., and I'm sure many places around the world, has become very dependent on the two-income household. And so, like you were saying, when there's only one income, or even when both are small, the numbers don't work. And I used to laugh back in the boom when people would talk about affordable housing. And their idea of affordable housing was to sell a house for $300,000 instead of $600,000. And I would just laugh at that because at that time, when I was arguing with my friends in real estate back then, and I was saying, you know, none of this is legitimate, it's all artificial, they would argue with me, and I would say, you don't have to look any farther than incomes. Incomes never went up overall. And so it was such a joke to talk about affordable housing like that. And, you know, with the low interest rates and all the creative financing, could people get some payments at the time? Sure, but all that's gone. Today, if you qualify, you know, one misconception a lot of people have is that the banks aren't lending money in mortgages. Well, they're certainly happy to lend money. Like I said, they're getting it all from Fannie Mae, which is who's getting it from the Federal Reserve. There's plenty of money available. But they've gone back to the more normal lending standards, which means you have to qualify, your debt-to-income ratios and all that kind of stuff is more reasonable, and you still have to qualify. If you qualify, it's easy to get a loan. But, you know, you've got to have that stable job history, you got to have the numbers you need, et cetera. But if you don't qualify, you know, it doesn't help you. And you're absolutely right, that's all about incomes. And our system, it's very much still not what it should be overall. And there are, for example, the politicians, the media, they like to throw around numbers about the top 1%, top 10%, top 50%, et cetera. Well, what they never do is they don't ever tell you what those numbers are. And when you go look at those numbers, it's amazing. You know, the top, I'm trying to remember now because I don't hold these numbers in my head, but it's like the top 5%, you're only at like $100,000 a year income or something like that. The top 50%, I think it's around 20-something to 30-something. And you're thinking, okay, that means that half the people in this country make less than $30,000 a year. It's just so crazy when you think about that.
Well, and so your average mortgage today for, like, say, a $250,000 house, your average mortgage payment is going to be in what arena, John? Can you tell us off the top of your head?
It's very difficult. Yeah. excuse me. I don't do mortgages, so I don't hold all those numbers in my head like a mortgage guy would. But, for example, I did just work on the numbers for somebody recently where the loan amount was going to be around $200,000. So if you were doing a, you can just figure whatever your down payment would be on top of that. But the loan amount was going to be around $200,000, and we figured that just the mortgage payment, forget about the taxes and insurance, which is included in most people's monthly payment. Just a mortgage payment on that would be around $1,000. So if you add in your few hundred dollars for taxes and a few hundred dollars for insurance every month, you could easily be getting close to $2,000. You know, you get at least over $1,500, $1,600 a month for a monthly mortgage payment. And that's very quickly becoming the price range for what I would call a good house in a good neighborhood. I mean, we had some very good times here locally where people were getting amazing prices on good houses and good neighborhoods, and anybody who could was snapping them up. But those days seem to be gone. And it's once again, if you want a payment of, you know, recently I worked with a friend who was willing to compromise on the neighborhood to get the house. And he was able to get a house at $100,000. And even there, his monthly payment is $1,000 a month, which is still a couple hundred dollars a month less than that house would rent. But he's getting an older house, and he got the space he needed. But it's an older house. He's going to spend plenty of money in maintenance, and he's still at $1,000 a month on one income. You know, that's probably at least a third of his monthly income right there, just going to that payment.
Well, and would it still be considered rule of thumb? I remember by the time I was 25, we had four kids, so we bought our first house in like 1973, 74, something like that. And it was $16,500. And our mortgage payment with taxes and insurance was about $600 a month. And that's because interest rates were pretty high even then.
Right.
But I remember the rule of thumb was your rent or your mortgage payment should be what you bring home in a week.
Exactly.
And
yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. And that's like the I'm not sure how to call them, but I call them the wise financial advisor types, like the Dave Ramsey types, people who still think that we need to live the way we used to live. That's what they'll tell you. One quarter of your take home should be going to your housing. That's the smart way to live, and it's very difficult to live that way these days.
Yeah, I think in the most part, a lot of people, you're seeing more than half of what they're bringing in is going just to the house expense itself, not even talking about utilities and everything, but just the house, the taxes, the insurance, and the mortgage, or the rent. And in some cases, it's even more than that. But I'm finding that a lot of people I know, it's closer to the 50% mark.
Right. I believe, and I wouldn't want to... I would tell somebody to check with a mortgage person before counting on these numbers, but I believe that the ratios to actually get a mortgage right now, the actual home payment, the mortgage payment itself, the monthly payment on the mortgage, the maximum I think you can get actually qualify for a mortgage is in the low 30% range, and the total debt to income ratios are in the high 40s. But that's just to qualify for a mortgage. If there are many people, I'm sure, that are paying much higher ratios in rent because right now rents are much higher than the mortgage payments because so many people are being forced to rent. So the rental market, the landlords are loving it. They're raking in the money and loving it, but it's terrible trying to find a place to rent that's affordable, that's in any kind of decent neighborhood. I feel so sorry for anybody looking for rentals these days.
Well, and, you know, there was a thing on TV the other day, and I've done a show about this, and, of course, I do this. I believe in pulling together and having multi-family homes, not multi-family, generational homes.
Right.
Back in the to survive in a farmhouse or something like that, great-grandma and great-grandpa, grandma and grandpa, mom and dad and the kids often all live together to help make sure that, first of all, the farm survived, and secondly, that they could pay the outside bills that they had. And today, there was a big thing on the 6 o'clock news the other night. A woman's husband died. She had a big five-bedroom home. She was going to have to leave it, and because there was just no way. I think a lot of us think that when we're married, we're going to be able, if something happens to our spouse, we're going to be able to keep collecting their Social Security. That's not true. You can fight to get part of it. If it's larger than yours, things like that, there are some things you can do, but to have both of those incomes after the demise of your spouse is pretty unheard of. So this lady didn't know what she was going to do, so she did like the Golden Girls. Put an ad in the paper, and she got four other ladies to come in, all the same scenario as she, raised their families, their spouses were gone, and now they're all living together in a very nice home, and they've got everything set up. Now, the likelihood of that working for everybody is not a big percentage. However, it is in a lot of families now. I looked this up, too. Remember when I did that show, Shell, and I was shocked to find out how many people are doing that today just to make ends meet.
Right,
just to
right.
make their combined.
And the whole thing is, one of the comments I made, and I'll just make this quickly and then we'll go back to John, but one of the big keys of making that work, because it is a great solution to have generational members of your family under one roof, get a large enough place, but you're having everybody pitch in, and it really does make it more affordable and more comfortable. You've got support there, but you have to set ground rules from the get-go. If everybody understands their place, what they should be doing, what's expected of them, what's expected of everybody else, and that kind of thing, then you don't start getting hard feelings and having it be difficult. So that actually is a very good solution, but you have to be smart going in and make sure that everybody understands and is cooperative, because I've seen it work. I mean, obviously it works in your home, and I've seen it work in other homes. And it can be a great way of people, especially in today's day, to kind of like pull back in and be more family-oriented.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea as well. And I spent quite a bit of my earlier years in a two-generation family, and I think it's a great idea. An interesting thought to add to that, a few years ago, I was reading a book on these guys that claimed to be able to forecast the big picture long-term, what our economy is going to do. Evidently, they did real well with forecasting what happened in 2008, and the funniest thing that I took away from their book is that they said that the U.S. eventually, because of all these things that you hear people talking about all the time, the federal debt, the inflation, all that kind of stuff, they said we're eventually going to head to the point where we're going to have something like 40% real unemployment in the U.S. But they said what that looks like for our society is 10 people living in one house together, one person has the job which puts the food on the table and keeps the lights on, and the rest of them sit around the house all day playing stolen video games and watching stolen movies.
Wow.
Okay.
And because the job market is so outrageously bad, it is very hard today to find a good job. It is very, very difficult to find a good job. Unless somebody you know is in a position who really knows you and trusts you, that's the best and easiest way to find a job.
Absolutely.
Any manager that's running a place, they put their own family to work. It's just the way of the world. I don't blame them.
Exactly.
I did the same thing. But that is what happens. So, but, you know, we could discuss this for like 6 days. The state of vacation and the fact that we all know that we're in trouble, even those of us who try to ignore some of it, we know that we are in trouble. If something doesn't happen soon, I mean, they talk about the unemployment rate going down. That's because 60% of the people I know who were unemployed in the year 2011 no longer collect unemployment because they can't.
Right.
Ran out. They're not a part of that history, and they still don't have a job. So the numbers out on TV and on 60 Minutes and all these kind of shows is, if you'll forgive the lingo, BS, because it's not true.
The critical number you always want to look at is not that rate number, which, like you said, they're taking numbers out of the denominator to bring that rate down, but you want to look at that labor force participation rate, and that's historical lows right now.
Explain that, John. Explain what you just said.
Right. Well, exactly what you were saying. In other words, they're taking out the people who stop, quote-unquote, looking for work, and they're saying, okay, well, the percentage of people who are looking for work versus people the percentage of people who are looking for work and haven't found it yet versus the percentage of people who have jobs, well, supposedly that keeps going down. But usually every month you'll hear I'll call it the regular media, say, oh, wow, the rate went down, and then you'll find the alternative media, the talk show guys, et cetera, saying, well, of course it went down because you took out this big chunk of people and said they weren't looking for work anymore, and then you and I say, hey, wait a minute, who's not looking for work? You know, who wouldn't like to have a job? So that's, you know, we all aren't that lazy. So the labor force participation rate is simply a number that compares the number of people actually working to, I think it's the, you know, I'd have to check to see if they include retired people in that number, if they take them out, but it's basically compared to the general population. And I believe we're getting close to 50% on that. I mean, it's very low. I think it's in the 50s. So that explains how many people are, you know, at home or out driving around in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the fact of the matter is, like I said, once they're taken off the books at the unemployment office, that's when they disappear from the records. Once they
right.
don't that money, and then, of course, you have the arena of people who can prove that they have no viable income and they're on food stamps, and, but they don't ever even put that into the mesh. I mean, they do
exactly.
do a private, or they, you know, they do a segregated ratio of how many people are getting some kind of public assistance, but they don't say why. They just kind of avoid that issue. Anyway, we'll stop discussing this because this is really not what I wanted to share with everybody
sure.
today, because I think most of us know this and it's upsetting for all of us. So, but I do want to help some people understand some of the real estate jargon, if you will. I mentioned to John last night on the phone, a lot of people I know, when they're looking for a house or a place to rent, or they want to move, or they need to upsize or downsize or whatever, they drive through neighborhoods and say they
really
see,
quick.
Yeah.
Sorry, I want to check myself. I believe the labor force participation rate includes working age persons. So, just based on that, I want to make sure they took the retired people out of that. And yes, that is very, very low right now. So, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That's true. I'm sorry I didn't mention that. But you drive around and you see these for sale signs, and you call the number on the for sale sign, and you get sometimes a voice or an answering machine. And the nice voice on the other side says, you know, you say what house you're looking at and everything, and they say somebody will be back in touch with you. And then you get a phone call and you say, oh, that house is in short sale. Let's meet and we'll do something together. Well, your regular run-of-the-mill person, a short sale sounds like, oh, good, that means it's going to be able to sell real fast. Isn't that what it sounds like?
Yeah.
That means, like, it's not tied up in a whole bunch of paperwork and everything, so that means I can probably get that one real fast if I can get okay for the loan, and I've already started those steps to be able to make sure that I can get a loan on my income and this and everything. You hear the terminology short sale, and you think it's a good thing. Is it a good thing, Jen?
Not generally. Not good for the sellers, not good for the buyers.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you the quick overview version of what that means. I spent quite a bit of time working on short sales, and I will say this, it has gotten much better than it used to be. I remember, I'll say 2009, 2010, when if anybody mentioned the word short sale, you automatically assumed that was a 9 to 12 month process. It was pretty crazy back then. But it's gotten a bit better. But basically, the technical definition of a short sale is when the seller is trying to sell the house for a price that's lower than what the price needs to be for them to pay off their mortgage. So, I guess the technical term for that is a short payoff to the mortgage company. And it's very common today, you would expect. I remember, again, going back to 2010, 2011, where the rule of thumb was that houses were selling for half of what people paid for them and at the peak. So plenty of people out there with huge mortgages compared to what they could sell the house for. It's been a development as the banks struggle with the situation and the government gets involved with different regulations and incentive programs, and the different banks approach things differently. But we've been in it long enough now that things are getting a bit smoother and more standardized. So generally, if somebody has a house where they have the big mortgage and either they can't afford to pay anymore, something changes in their life, or, of course, there are plenty of people who just decide to give up and stop paying and figure it's not no reason to keep paying on that thing. The way the process works is the house has to go on the market first, and we disclose that it is a short sale. And once somebody makes an offer on that house and there's a contract executed between the buyer and seller, then a nice big package of paperwork has to be filled out, mostly by the seller. The buyer really doesn't care or have to do anything except wait, and that package of paperwork will go to the lender, and basically it's our proposal to them of what we want to do, and once the lender receives that and processes it, then they will order what we call a BPO, stands for Broker Price Opinion, and sometimes, you know, they're actually ordering full, that's an opinion of value done by a realtor. And then also sometimes they will do a full appraisal as well with a certified appraiser. They'll go out and they will evaluate the property, and they are the bank's third-party opinion of the value. And generally, it used to be, I remember the days where everybody thought they saw a short sale and said, oh, I can get a great deal here. Well, that's not been my experience. They are very insistent on getting full market value these days, or if Fannie Mae is behind the loan, which... they're behind practically every loan these days because they bought up all the bad loans from these banks. They seem to just not care what the market value is, and they just decide whatever number they want. So I've had some very frustrating experiences where Fannie Mae demanded much more than anybody thought the house was worth, buyers, sellers, agents, etc., and they wouldn't budge much. And I think that this is just my guess, but it's a consensus among everybody in the industry, is that they are the not just 800-pound, but 10,000-pound gorilla in the room, and they've decided that they're going to do what they want to do, and they're going to try to push the market up. So by demanding high prices on the houses that they own, because many bank-owned properties end up in Fannie Mae's name as well, and then also when they control these sales prices with the short sales, they will just demand high numbers, and through their force throughout the market, they'll push the market up. And I think they probably have had some effect in that. So a lot of times that's one of the most frustrating parts of the process, is when the bank wants much more than the buyer wants to pay, and the realtors, the seller can't find anybody else who will pay what the bank wants to pay, and then things sit around and drag on until somebody gets real and decides to make the thing happen. So at some point you find some agreement on that price, and then it can move forward with a normal closing. And then of course there's often a second mortgage involved, and usually you don't really negotiate with them very much until you get your approval from the first. So there's some more time that you hopefully that moves fast, but sometimes that can hold things up. And then sometimes you get a mortgage insurance company involved, and they can be ornery and stubborn. So it's I don't claim to understand how it all works, but my impression is that the banks generally like to do short sales. They want to do short sales. There are some kind of incentives there, whether it's from the government or tax write-offs or whatever it is in their level. They have some good incentives to do short sales, but every once in a while you hit somebody who says, no, I don't want to do that, I'm not budging, and they can mess the whole thing up. So from a buyer's perspective, best case scenarios I've seen is two to three to four months is from start to finish, and I've seen plenty of situations where the whole thing fell apart and never went anywhere, and that can be very frustrating for a buyer because they sit around for a few months only to find out it's not gone anywhere. Now they have to go out and look again. They might have missed something along the way. So it's a frustrating process for everybody involved, but at least it has gotten better than it was a couple years ago.
And there's several different types of short sales. There's a standard short sale. I'm involved in a standard short sale right now, but the paperwork was submitted to me by my lender was for a half a short sale, HAFA. I forgot what the acronym is for. But basically on a half a short sale is where you have to give them what your income is at the time, and they will order you to pay 30% of your income, but they look at it regardless of what your expenses are. So once I looked at and I read the rules for it, I was like, well, I just showed you that my income is this and my expenses are this, and they're just about equal. So I rejected the half of the HAFA short sale. And you have to fill out a whole disclaimer form on that. And they moved forward negotiating with the real estate anyway, and allowed me to list it as a short sale. But if I hadn't been advised about that from the real estate guy, because he helped me go through the paperwork, I would have signed it because I didn't understand what it meant. And so that's just something that if anybody is looking to go into a short sale situation, I was out of work for a year and a half, and during that time, obviously, I wasn't able to pay the mortgage. I was bringing in just enough money to, like, keep my lights on, put food on the table, but, you know, I had a huge monthly payment, and there was no way I could even come up with half of it. And I tried to do mortgage mods. They didn't work out, you know, things like that. So I'm in a short sale situation right now. But interestingly, and again, I'm not savvy about this. I'm just kind of like going through the process and learning a little bit here and a little bit there. A lot of times I'll pick up one thing that doesn't make sense to me and I question it and then I move forward. But I certainly don't understand all the inner workings. It's just like certain things like the HAFA. If somebody's going to a short sale, make sure that you understand what that means before you sign all the papers. The general packet you get is like about a dozen pages. Make sure you understand the purpose of each one of those. You don't have to understand all the other contracts, but understand the initial package. It's not that much and question everything. But I'm going through my third BPO now. I have the broker and a lender representative are coming back out to my house tomorrow, and this is the third BPO in 6 months. So, you know, I don't know why they keep redoing it, but, you know,
right.
It's just adding time to
right.
the whole process.
Yeah, they generally have expiration dates on those, and they're pretty rigid about updating that value when it expires because basically, like I said, you go back a few years, people were scamming the government, they were scamming the banks, people were getting, they were ripping them off, they were buying houses at much less than they were worth, and the banks were getting ripped off and scammed by everybody, which doesn't make too many people unhappy. But they've put in all kinds of quality control measures, such as, right, you know, doing multiple BPOs every few months. And, the HAFA, that's one of the government programs that was created to try to give the banks some incentives in this stuff. And I forgot to finish what I was the process. So once you get all those things worked out, and you get through that process, and you can get to the closing. Generally, if it's your personal residence and you had a legitimate hardship, which they have actually made it really easy on some of them. If you have a real hardship, they minimize the documentation. You don't have to fill out a lot of these forms you used to have to fill out. But like I said, if it was your personal residence and you had a legitimate hardship, and they don't see you as somebody who has $1 million tucked away somewhere that you're just refusing to pay your mortgage or et cetera, or you have a lot of other assets, then a lot of times they will do a full forgiveness on those mortgages. And it's very nice, and you'd be amazed at how much they'll forgive on these mortgages, the debts, and I'm sure there's some benefits to them,
right.
Whether it's a write-off or anything else. And it can be a very good experience for the seller in the end, and you can move on with your life free of the debt, fully forgiven, and depending on your situation, especially if your hardship was legitimate and your situation has changed since then, your mortgage options may be pretty good within a year maybe or two. And for the buyers, just to go back to that for 1 second, for a buyer looking at a short sale, I guess the best thing you can say is that you don't have as much competition because a lot of people don't want to look at them. So if you have your eyes set on a certain house, you might have a lot less competition from other buyers. You may not get a good deal. You may have to pay full market value, but at least you'll be the one. Whereas in many other situations in today's market, for example, a bank-owned house, something that looks really good, a lot of people go after it, and you might be one of 5, one of 10, one of 20 offers, and it's your chances of getting that house are not very good. So that's the flip side of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, that's it. I'm glad you just shared that with us because I have somebody who's a close friend other than what Shelley's going through, somebody who just lost her husband, and they were in the middle of trying to work out a bankruptcy deal. I think I explained this to you last night. And you saying this gives me a little bit of hope for her. I may see if I can get her in touch with you, John. Would that be all right?
Sure, yeah. And that's definitely one of the things on the list. If the loan is owned by Fannie Mae, I believe, and you've lost a spouse and that was a primary source of income, Supposedly it's pretty close to automatic. They don't really make you, I mean, well, you know, I shouldn't say anything for sure, but they've tried to make it easier for people in those situations. And they try to streamline it and make the process move along faster. And so, yeah, it's definitely something that should be investigated there.
Well, and I you know, considering all the negative things that we've said about the way we, as the people, handle things and the way the people that are in these arenas for money and mortgages and banks and Fannie Mae and all the other things that are out there, it seems like hearing one nice thing like that, you know, is a nice thing to be able to spread around today on top of all the other negativity. So,
the government tries. The government has
really,
a good heart.
Yeah.
But they're not very good at it.
We have to be able to every now and then find something positive in such an arena of despair. And people don't really care what it is. Just one little thing gives them continued ability to hope for something good happening to them. And let's face
right.
it, that's the name of the game today. You have to be able. One of the things I used to teach at the Institute was the most important thing an institute like that gives back to somebody is hope. And if you're,
yeah.
you know, if you're out there homeless people, I've done so many shows on homeless people, it's horrific how many homeless people there are in South Florida. Horrific. And there's lots of organizations out there now that are trying to help, but they're only as good as the people that are involved in them. So it's kind of a vicious circle. So I'm glad we got something good out of all of this. But I do have a couple
yeah, definitely.
Of things.
I was going to say real quick, definitely my main point I try to get across to people with short sales is that it can often work out very well, especially if you had a legitimate hardship, and it's always something you should try, but you don't want to wait too long. A lot of people, they get stuck in that situation where the foreclosure is dragging on. They think, I wonder how long I can live in this house without paying this mortgage. It's, you know, save up my money. Well, you run out of time, and your options get limited. So I always tell people, you don't want to wait too long to give it a try. And the good news about short sales is that you're in control the whole time. Nobody can force you to do anything. So if you get to the end and you have some reason to back away from it, you always do have that option. But it can work out very well for most people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I'll say with regard to having issues with your home or any debt for that matter, this particular advice I'm going to give you has to do with any creditor debt, is not to avoid your creditors. Big, big, big
mm-hmm.
mistake.
Absolutely.
Their jobs, they're having financial problems, and the credit card company's calling them, the mortgage company's calling them, and what they do is they shrink and they won't answer their phone. And what happens with that, if a creditor can't get in touch with you, they will move out and take advantage of whatever legal remedy is available to them. But
sure,
if you just
absolutely.
And talk to them, explain to them your circumstances, it's amazing how willing they are to work with somebody they know is not hiding from them. Because I had problems with one card I had. I had a problem with a couple of my bills. In one case, I got a four-month extension on a credit card, and they didn't charge me any late fees. They waived all the late fees, and it took me 4 months to finally make a payment to them. But I took the calls. I talked to them. I explained to them. I told them I was trying to work on something to get the money, and they cooperated with me. I know other people that got their cards taken away after month three and with all kinds of fines and penalties, and then they were sued and all this. And the difference between them and me is that I kept that line of communication open. And the same thing with my mortgage company. So when I decided to do the short sale, they were very cooperative, and they kind of walked me through the process.
Well,
yes,
I think
absolutely. Good advice.
Yeah, putting our heads in the sand doesn't work for anything. It doesn't work for monetary problems. It doesn't work for social problems. It doesn't work for anything. It just gets sand in your ear. So one quick thing, though. I have all these list of words that I wanted. How do you feel about a reverse mortgage for a retired couple? That's all over the television.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Sure. You know, I really see that not so much as a real estate question as a financial advisor question. I don't claim to know too much about it. I know that Dave Ramsey hates them. He's the guy over on one side of the spectrum. I know that my brother, who is a very, I highly respect him as a financial advisor. I don't think he has too many good things to say about them from a financial advisor perspective. So I really see that if somebody's thinking about that, don't talk to a real estate person about it. Talk to a financial advisor who you trust first. And because really it's a numbers question. It's always about the numbers. And the mortgage industry is really pushing them because they're profitable and it's an easy sell. But, I've
so
never
you
gotten anything.
In the commercials for those type of mortgages, it always says, and you still own your home. But I noticed this the other day. I was seeing one of the commercials. I don't know if it was Henry Winkler or the other guy. But when it showed, it says, and you still own your home, and there was an asterisk there. So there's some small, there's some fine print with regard to that. And
right.
If you don't know what that fine print is, you may put yourself in a position where you don't own your own home anymore. And I don't know what that would be, but I noticed
right.
a little asterisk.
Just remember this. Somebody's making money that's making it worth it for them to do this. So you got to figure out where they're making their money before you really understand what's going on.
Well, that's a good rule of thumb as well. And what about when you call and somebody says to you on the phone, you call about a house or you're interested in something you've even seen online, and they say that house is in foreclosure. You've only got 4 minutes left. Can you give us a real rough foreclosure? Is time-consuming? What's the scoop on foreclosure?
Right. Okay, sure. Foreclosure used to be a very lengthy process here in Florida, and people really milked the system. They got the attorneys in there. The attorneys used a bunch of procedural tools to bog things down to the point where you heard crazy stories about people living in a house for 2, 3, 4 years without paying a mortgage. My understanding and my impression is that the state has been doing some things, the local judicial system has been doing some things to speed that up. I saw recently was involved in a short sale where the foreclosure started and ended within a year, and that really caught us by surprise how fast they moved. But a lot, sometimes that can be dependent on how fast the bank moves. But yes, basically when somebody stops paying at some point, it's at the bank's discretion because they tell their attorneys when to do what, but at some point they'll start that foreclosure process. It goes through legal process, and there are many steps along the way. At some point, the judge gavel comes down, he gives you your judgment and sends the thing to auction, and then it will sell at the courthouse, the foreclosure auction. And at that point, either a private investor will buy it or the bank will take it back, and then it'll become a bank-owned house and come on the market. So anybody who is facing that, I always tell them, it all depends on your situation and what your goal is here. If you're giving up, you're desperate, you have no money, well then go get an attorney, pay him $300 a month, and maybe he'll keep you in the house for an extra 6 months while you figure out your situation. But whatever you do, don't ignore it, like we were saying before. And but for somebody who's buying and they hear that story, really the only chance they have of getting it is unless, you know, the good old days when the payoff was low enough, you could just say, hey, I'll pay off your mortgage, we'll get you out of foreclosure, and I'll take the house and give you a little cash.
Mm-hmm.
That's rare these days. It's just not an option. But it does happen. But otherwise, it's a short sale situation is your only chance of getting the house. Or you just wait and see what happens, and a year later, it might become available. But as a buyer, it's really not. It used to be that that's how you got your good deals, because the balances were low and the banks just want to get rid of houses, et cetera, but that's very rare today.
Well, and I think we're down to just a little bit over a minute, but I do think that it is an issue with houses sitting empty, especially here.
Yes.
Right. Those are usually
street.
In some kind of limbo. Usually when you see that, there's some kind of legal limbo or something's happening because the banks don't like to leave them sit empty if they can avoid it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you, John. I knew that this would be an interesting conversation and we would get off on tangents because that's what good conversations
yeah.
I'd like to back again
sure.
All you have to do is call when you've got time or would like to do this again. We would love to have you back on the show. I think these questions are important in today's in the way everybody is trying to handle everything, and you hear so much stuff out there, especially on the media, that misleads people and puts them in a place where they can't understand why they can't do it, because they just saw Henry Winkler tell them they could, you know. So there's lots of things that we can set straight and lots of things that we can help people with. So thank you so much again. It was great, and I look forward to another show. So I hope you'll call me and we can make another date. Thanks, Shell, and thanks for your story as well. I want to send everybody out there to have a great, great day. I know it's Monday. Have a good day, and God bless, and we'll be back tomorrow morning with Bullies to Buddies. Thanks very much, everybody. Bye, you guys. Thank you.
Bye, John. Thanks. Bye, Renee.
Have a great day.
You
Thanks,
too.
John.
Bye.